Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
It just all feels one and the same. When I'm taking care of my kids, I get ideas for paintings. When I'm away from my kids painting, I miss them and I feel like I should be with them. It's all very fluid for me. There's not a separation. There's people that wake up and go to work 9 to 5 and they come home. It's not that way at all for me. It's just everything is studio. In a studio, the playroom is studio, you know, everything is studio for me.
It's my pleasure to welcome Kimia Ferdowsi-Klein to the Artist Mother Podcast today. Kimia earned an MFA at the San Francisco Art Institute and holds a BFA in painting from Washington University in St. Louis, where she was awarded a full tuition Danforth Scholarship. She has mounted solo exhibitions at Turn Gallery in New York, Morrow Gallery in San Francisco, the Elaine Jacobs Gallery at Wayne State University in Detroit, and 68 projects in Berlin. Select group shows include Cezanne Benetier, the Museum of Contemporary Art Detroit, Canada Gallery, Vanderbilt University, and the Drawing Center. In 2015, Kimia was awarded a grant and residency through the New York Foundation for the Arts. In 2018, she was honored to be nominated for a Rima Hortman Emerging Artist Grant. Guest lectures and teaching include Yale University, Vanderbilt, Tyler School of Art and Architecture, SUNY Purchase, the Fashion Institute of Technology, Brooklyn College, Wayne State University, and Chautauqua Institute. And as a freelance curator, Kimia also consults for various private collectors and corporations. Kimia, you're currently living in Nashville, Tennessee, I believe, with your family. I'm really excited to chat with you and just connect today. Thanks so much for doing this and taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so great to see you again.
I know. We've connected a little bit. I had you do an artist talk for a community, and I'm just a big fan of your work. So,
oh, you're so kind. Thank you.
That's really the main reason I want to do this interview, but I also know that you're just, you know, a delight to talk to. So I'm excited. Kimia, I would love for you to just kind of give us a bit of background. I always like to know if folks, you know, because it's like an artist parent podcast, I'm always interested in like the idea of how we're raising our kids to be exposed to art as parents. Mm-hmm. And if you as an artist were exposed to art as a kid, if it was like part of your culture growing up, or if it was like something that you didn't really know anything about until you know, gotten to a certain point. So what are some threads that are connecting there?
I just love that question so much. I never get asked that. I was born and raised in Nashville, Tennessee, to Iranian refugee parents. So my family were members of the Baha'i faith, which is very persecuted in Iran. And so they had to be smuggled out of the country and they came to the U.S. as refugees. So I was raised in Nashville before there was an art museum in Nashville.
Mm, before the Frist?
Yeah, the Frist opened when I was 17.
I didn't know that. That's
yes. Cool. So the whole time that I was growing up, we had no art museum. And the art that I was exposed to was mainly outsider art. So like Southern outsider, like, you know, people painting on rocks and, you know, old doors and like whatever they had lying around in their front yard. I saw a lot of folk art and I saw a ton of Persian carpets because that is what was in my house and my aunt and uncle's homes. So I was really initially exposed primarily to folk art and Persian textiles, like miniatures and carpets and rugs. So I think I just love that question because I talk about it in my artist statement as being my earliest influences. And I think if you look at my work, you can so directly see.
Yeah. When you were painting on rocks, I was like, don't you use found wood?
I sure do. And I didn't realize the connection. It's like, I came back to that after all of like this really rigid, precise oil painting traditional training that I experienced in my education. I came back to just sort of being this, I guess, outsider artist, Persian American artist in my 30s, when I just kind of allowed myself to follow my curiosity. So yeah, in terms of what I expose my kids to, I really try to show them that art can be anything. We make a lot of art together, and I'm really inspired by them. I'm also really inspired by children's art. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that a contemporary art world existed until I was 17 or 18. And I was at Borders bookstore and I saw their art section, mm-hmm. and I stumbled upon a book by Eric Fischel. And this is like before Google. I'm not that old, but like, yeah. So much technologically. So I stumbled upon a book by Eric Fischel and I was like, oh my goodness, like painters have existed since Van Gogh. Like in my mind, all I'd seen was, you know, the impressionist section at like the Art Institute of Chicago when we went on a trip. Or we went to Rome to visit a family member and I saw the Sistine Chapel. So like my idea of art was that it kind of had like ended.
Yeah.
That book on Eric Fischel like changed my life. And I started after school every day going back to Borders and just sitting for hours in the art section looking at these books. And that's when I realized that, oh, I could like actually be a painter as a profession. But I did not know that like a contemporary art world existed. And I tell people that, and I think it's so that I'm making it up, but I'm really not. I had no exposure.
Which is also funny because you were exposed to art, but you talked about it as like outsider art or folk art. But then it's like seeing it in a book, you're like, oh no, this is like capital A art. And so it's like interesting to hear you like kind of
that is interesting
enter back into like what is art, but then now you're almost I'm assuming as a contemporary artist now you're like dismantling that, where you're like
totally.
No, like folk art is capital A art, and you know it's so kind of like true. All comes full circle, I guess.
That's a really, really good point that I had not thought about. Yeah, you said it perfectly. I have nothing to add to that. Everything you said. That's it.
I'm not meaning to like, you know, dismantle anything you said, but just it's just interesting like something feels official when it's like in a book or
I think for me, the Eric Fischel paintings, there was like an emotion that they conveyed to me that I had never felt looking at folk art. Mm-hmm. And there was emotion and like a contemporary sort of like here and now moment that he captured in his work that I didn't feel when I looked at Persian carpets. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It was like a real sort of currency. Like this is what life, day-to-day life for this guy is right now. expressed in a way that I could just feel it in my 17-year-old bones, you know, that I didn't feel like outsider art, it didn't give me that same rush. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's what I was searching for at that time. I understood folk art and outsider art, all that stuff for me was so much about making. Mm-hmm. It was just about the creative impulse. And coming upon Eric Fischel's work, I think, and all the other work that I, you know, was exposed to at Borders, it felt like, oh, there's also a conceptual bend to this.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like the art that you grow up around, you're not necessarily having a conversation about that art.
Yeah.
Because it's just kind of like a part of what's in your environment, whereas it's like you had this moment where you were like, oh, there's art that people are talking about.
Yes.
And, you know, and then you can kind of like move back into that with what you're making now and like the art that you like now. It's like that all is like a part of the same world now.
Yes. So I think it was all of the influences played different roles.
Yeah.
In sort of forming my current practice and aesthetic. And, realizing that there were like living artists making paintings that and taught, you know, they were teaching and supporting themselves in this way, it just became clear to me like, oh, this is an actual career option. I didn't know that it was. Mm-hmm. And that was really, really exciting. Because from childhood, I felt such a pull to be an artist. It was like always, apparently my parents say that at age 8, I declared I was going to be an artist. I don't remember that, but they swear by it. So I always
But you felt did go to undergrad and got a BFA in painting.
I did. So, but I also minored in business and okay. I minored in Persian and Farsi.
Oh, cool.
I didn't go to a quote art school like RISD. I went to WashU in St. Louis, which is known for medicine and engineering. And they have a phenomenal art and architecture program. But, the choice not to go to a traditional art school was my family being like, just in case.
Yeah.
some backups. But I always knew that it was going to be this or nothing. So.
Mm. Kimia, I would love for you to describe your art for folks listening so they can kind of like start to picture, you know, what you're making as we continue our conversation. I would love for you to just talk a little bit about what your art looks like and a bit about the process of making it.
Okay. So like the hardest question ever.
I know, especially for you, because you have a diverse practice.
I do. So I have like a very multidisciplinary practice. So the paintings exist on papyrus, on Egyptian papyrus, which if you've ever been to the Met or any museum that has an Egyptian section, you probably know what papyrus looks like. It's like a beige brown paper made from the papyrus plant. And I order mine from Egypt directly. I have a hookup there. So he sends me my papyrus. And it gives the work a really sort of textured and imperfect feel because the papyrus undulates. When you put ink or water or paint onto it, it starts to ripple a little bit. The edges are frayed. It's never the corners are not right in terms of the angle. They're not right angles. They're always a little bit wobbly. So there's like a very organic feel just to the actual surface I'm painting on. And then I really only use at this point calligraphy ink, which is basically it's an acrylic ink used for writing calligraphy, but I use it for painting. So the colors are very vibrant and they sit right on the surface of the papyrus. And it's a mix of, I would say, like opacity and transparency. I'll also use oftentimes gemstones. So you'll see rubies or pearls or glass beads sewn into the work. So the surface of my paintings are rarely just flat. They have this papyrus that's like undulating and fraying at the edges. They have ink. And then on top of the ink, there are often gemstones sewn into it. In terms of the actual content, I am almost always dealing with the human figure.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my work centers around my personal experience in this world, which is as a woman, as a mother, as a daughter, as a wife. So the narratives around those roles that I occupy are what I'm exploring. So you'll see figures. Sometimes it's clearly a woman. Sometimes it's androgynous. I also want the work to have a universal appeal. So, you know, gender is fluid in my work, but certain pieces are very specifically about a female experience like birth or menstruation. So you'll see figures oftentimes. And then those are paintings. And then I also have a sculpture practice, which is on wood. So I've been collect pieces of wood that I find when I go on walks, if I'm, in dumpsters, I had a tree fall down in my yard and I had the tree milled into these like beautiful pedestals and columns. So I'm always salvaging wood, and sometimes I paint on it with oil paint or ink or oil pastel. So they're also very brightly colored. And sometimes I'll just leave it raw and like let the sun bleach it or give it a stain. Sometimes I'll burn the wood. And then most recently I started doing textiles. So I made my first ever rug, and I had these beautiful artisans in Peru hand weave the rug from alpaca and wool, and the pattern was hand-dyed and it turned out really beautifully. So I'm doing another series of tapestries right now, actually in India, in Jaipur. And that relates back to my Iranian heritage. I come from a long lineage of carpet dealers. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, Persian carpets are something that I grew up around. So I feel very much like it's my birthright to be able to make tapestries. And I'm just now, you know, dabbling into this new medium. But I hope that gives kind of an overview.
Perfect. You were like, oh, I hate this question. And I'm like, but you're perfectly, you know, I have your...
Just Google it. Just Google it.
Yes, but I...
You don't have to look
interesting to hear an artist talk about what they think their art looks like and like what their art is doing in the world, you know, versus...
Because it's probably delusional. Someone else is like, no, it's not this at all. Crazy.
No, I thought it was like absolutely spot on. I want to chat a bit about your practice, but I feel like maybe providing some context for, you know, your life, like your caregiving, how old your kids are. Tell us like who you are outside of your practice, and then we'll kind of dive back into like what your studio practice is looking like these days.
Yeah, I don't feel like it's not like I'm in my practice or out of my practice. My practice is just my life. I'm never out of my practice. I feel like motherhood is a huge part of my practice and a huge part of my content of what I make and why. And, you know, I started using glitter in my paintings after I became a mom, and because I became a mom, you know, I was reintroduced to glitter. I have two daughters, ages 6.5 and 2.5 right now. And, life is just like it's like a big soup, you know.
Yes.
My studio is it's a standalone building, but it's in our front yard. So it's
okay,
basically. And the kids are in my studio painting with me. I get less work done when they're there, but they are there. They help me stand. They give me ideas. My eldest daughter is really quite talented, and she'll tell me when something is really good or not working, and I really value her perspective. Being a mother for me has made the work, it's clarified what I'm interested in making work about. Really struggled with content in undergrad and in grad school. Like, what am I making these paintings about? What is this about? And it was always about, in some form, womanhood and the female experience and the society's expectations on women. And then becoming a mom really helped me sort of sift through the narrative and what I was really interested in talking about. It just all feels one in the same. When I'm taking care of my kids, I get ideas for paintings. When I'm away from my kids painting, I miss them and I feel like I should be with them. It's all very fluid for me. It's all, there's not a separation. There's not, there's people that wake up and go to work 9 to 5 and they come home. It's not that way at all for me. It's just, everything is studio. In a studio, the playroom is studio, you know, everything is studio for me.
Yeah, it's more like studio is a state of being than just like a place that you go to or...
Totally, yeah. My quote unquote, like physical studio is where I produce the work because I don't want to get calligraphy ink on my couch.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the process, what's going on in my mind is everywhere. And I have a sketchbook next to my bed. I use my daughter's sketchbook sometimes, steal from her sometimes, her drawings, because they're so good and I'll get ideas from them. Yeah, it's an ongoing curiosity, I think.
Well, tell me a little bit about it, like in when you have a block of time where you're in the studio.
Yeah.
What are you? I find this question like interesting for folks who are very like multidisciplinary, because it's just kind of interesting to think about like how you move from like different mediums and materials, like how you decide sort of like what you're focusing on. You can talk practically about like what you did the last couple times you were in the studio, but just, you know, or give us more of like a general overview, but like, you know, are you just kind of grabbing, oh, this block of wood looks interesting right now, so I'm going to work on that? Or is there like, I decided I'm going to make 10 paintings on paper and that's what I'm going to work on now. Like, kind of talk me through like how you're making decisions in terms of how you're structuring your studio time.
Okay. That's a really good question. There's a few factors. One of the factors is exhaustion. How did I sleep last night? Did someone wake me up at 3 a.m? On the days where I have a lot of energy is when I tackle the sculptures, because mm-hmm. I'm using a bandsaw, I'm using a grinder. It takes like a lot of physical, it's loud. It takes mm-hmm. a lot of energy. I recently have started carving the wood. So it's like very, it takes my body. It takes the work of my body to do the sculptures. So I don't do that on days that I'm exhausted. I do that on days that I have a lot of energy. It's also very dependent on what projects I have coming up. So mm-hmm. for example, I am very honored. I have a show coming up at the Frist, actually.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Here in Nashville, the only museum in Nashville, art museum, January 2026. So okay. I have a May deadline because that's when the photographer is coming to shoot the work for the show.
Oh my gosh.
Right now I am working on the pieces that are going to be in the Frist show, but okay. those pieces still have not been finalized. There's like by the curators. So there's a list of a few that are potentially going to be in it. So I'm kind of like going full force in terms of the wood, the paintings and the tapestries, the woven pieces to have enough so that once the selections are made, I'll be able to have a great presentation in the museum. Mm. So there are the deadlines that like the shows that I have coming up determine the work that's being made. But also there's a lot, I give myself a lot of room to follow my intuition and my curiosity. And sometimes I'll just sit in there and I'll have no idea what mm-hmm. to do. And I'll just sit and meditate and look around and be like, oh, I haven't thought about this drawing. This drawing is still unfinished. What if I put some pink in the sky, you know, whatever. Yeah. So there's a lot of playfulness. I leave a lot of room for play, but I also have to get my work done. Mm-hmm. My work that's due. So it's a back and forth, because if I have too many deadlines and too many things that I quote have to finish, it starts to feel, it starts to close down my interest. And so I have to leave myself a lot of openness to play and experiment and just kind of wander. I just mm-hmm. do a lot of wandering, and I'm always kind of surprised at the fact that anything gets finished. I don't know how things get finished. Somehow they do. I don't know when they do, but somehow they do.
Exhibition and residency open call for artists' parents. Woohoo! So thrilled to share the open call titled Double Duty with you from Kinhouse Art in Fort Wayne, Indiana. We believe that artist parents need time and space to create, and you need a platform to share your work. So in collaboration with the Artist Mother podcast, Kinhouse Gallery seeks to provide a supportive environment and nourishing resource to help artist parents thrive. Two selected artists will receive a one-month exhibition at our gallery. This will be a two-person show. A week-long stay at our artist residency in Fort Wayne, Indiana, that you can book anytime during the 2026 calendar year. An interview on the Artist Mother podcast, published sometime in 2026. Promotion and marketing of your artwork on the Kinhouse platform, newsletter, and local press outlets, as well as the Artist Mother podcast platform. And an exhibition reception on Saturday, April 11th, 2026. As artist parents ourselves, we understand the challenge and complexity involved when you are making art and raising humans. That's why I started this podcast. So this exhibition and residency opportunity was created to respond for the need for emerging and mid-career artists to have opportunities to make and show their work in inclusive spaces. We would really like you to submit to this open call on behalf of yourself. And part of the curation of the open call is that we will pick two artists to receive the residency opportunity, and you will get the two-person show together. This open call is available for persons of all genders and backgrounds, just as long as you identify as a parent. The exhibition opening will take place again on Saturday evening, April 11th, 2026, and the residency dates are flexible and can be scheduled anytime during the 2026 calendar year. Apply at kinhouseart.com/calls to see this open call, double duty, and we can't wait to see your work. Kimia, it looks like, when I look through your work, it looks like there's like so many artists, I feel like, pick a size. And they're like, I'm going to make a certain amount of work in this size.
Yeah.
That
sounds so boring.
Yeah. Oh. Well, like, one of the things I love about your work is it seems like every individual piece, whether it's wood or paper, has a different shape to it.
That's so funny. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it has its own presence as an individual. Outside yeah. of, like, this is one of 10 paintings in the same body of work. It's like, no, this is like a standalone figure in a way, you know?
Yeah. I take that as a great compliment.
Yeah. I mean it as a compliment, but I'm also, like, just curious, because I find that, like, sometimes for me, a little bit of structure helps me have an entry point, mm-hmm. right? Like, just making a decision of, like, I think I'll make 5 paintings about the same size. Here's the size. It's like, it helps me
start.
Yeah, it helps me start, because when I think I have, like, a lot of intimidation around, like, the blank canvas, or, like, right. the, like, just the, like, no agenda, you know, which I'm not saying you don't have an agenda, but I'm just curious, you know, like, I don't know, like, the entry point.
Yeah, the entry point. Okay, so that's really interesting. I get bored. Yeah. I get bored. I've never in my life, never could I sit down and say to myself, I'm going to make 5 of the same size. Like, you might as well, like, slit my wrists. Like, that, like.
The disgust.
It's not even that. That would be torture. It would yeah. feel like torture to me to be that, like, roped in. But how do I start? This is a really good question. How do I start? I start with small, sometimes I start with small sketches in my sketchbook of just mm-hmm. drawings out of my head.
Gonna ask if you have a sketchbook practice.
I have like 700 sketchbooks.
Okay. Which are mostly like drawing. Like a drawing practice, or what, you know, because some people have a sketchbook that's like collage or painting, or.
No, never collage. It's pen, ink, and pastel, and okay. sometimes marker, like very okay. specific drawing. I also have a huge just catalog of printouts, of photos, of collected images, of family photos, of magazine clippings. So I have this archive, this well of imagery, mm-hmm. and that I can always go back to when I'm feeling stuck or bored. And that's kind of, and then also I wanted to be a double major in literature. I love the written word. I love poetry. Mm-hmm. I love, I just love language. And so also I have lists and lists and lists of titles, of phrases, of poems. And so a lot of the paintings actually start from experiences in my mind or feeling. Mm-hmm. It will start from a feeling. And I'll think about, like, the feeling. For example, I'll give you one of the first papyrus pieces I ever made. It's called Domino. And it's one of the first cutouts when I started cutting out holes like directly into the papyrus pieces. It was a real breakthrough piece for me. It was made during COVID in 2020. And that was also the first time I started sewing pearls into the work. And it came from, the drawing came from just the experience of holding a baby. This idea of cradling a head, this idea of holding and of being held myself. My doula's name is Domino, with the birth of my first daughter. So I titled it Domino after her. But then I also thought about dominoes and how it's it can be a chain reaction, and how motherhood is such a chain reaction in terms of like what we pass on and generational trauma and all these things. But that piece started from a feeling, and I was like, how, and I really wanted to get away from looking at photography during that portion of my studio practice. So it was the constraint that I gave myself was that I can't look at any photos. It has to come from my head. It has to come from my subconscious. What I was interested in mining the images inside my consciousness, inside my body, inside my soul. I was like, I can't find this in the outside world. It has to come from within. So that whole series came, and that's why it's not anatomically correct. Like there's always mistakes. It's always like fumbling through figuring out how to make the body work in an aesthetic way. So I guess, I hope that's an answer to your question.
Absolutely.
Often it starts with a feeling. And then, so once I have the drawing, then I'll go in with the color. Mm-hmm. And then the color and the form work together. That's why I love papyrus and wood, because I can shape it. Mm-hmm. Like I need more here, and I'll sew another patch, or I'll need to take something away and I can cut it away. So it's this very sort of organic, fluid process between the 2D form of the drawing and the 3D form of the structure of the paper or the wood. And those two things slowly come together to form a finished piece. In terms of all of them looking like their own individual, like you said, statues or bodies, I really appreciate that, because I cannot stand monotony in terms of art. And I always am trying to break through the next level. And so it's not even that it's like, I physically can't make the same work twice. I've had multiple galleries. There's one painting in particular, it's called Hex. And every gallery is like, where is this painting? We want this painting. Please figure out how to remake this painting. And I'm just like, guys, I can't do that. I'm sorry. Just physically, it's like, I'm like, have a physical reaction when I try to make the same thing. There's just something about it. It's like an intellectual challenge and hurdle. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready for the next thing. What's the next thing? I had a really lovely studio visit last September with a curator who said, she was like, Kimia, each of these pieces feel like you could do a whole series from one of them. She was like, I encourage you to go back and look at each one. She was like, and she said, why don't you just try and make the same painting twice? Mm-hmm. I said, you know what? That's such a great piece of advice. And I was feeling a little stuck. So I went back to one of my early papyrus drawings and I tried to make it again and I couldn't. And what I made instead was so much better. Mm-hmm. And then that's kind of
was your entry point, I guess.
That was my entry point. Yeah. So I think at this point I have my own database of imagery, not only from my sketchbooks, not only from found photos, but also from previous paintings that I'm now ripping, that I can like riff off of and reuse. And so, yeah, that was a long-winded answer.
No, I love it. And it's not that the intention, just to like kind of finish your thought, I guess, it's not that the intention is to remake the same piece necessarily, but to just...
What else can you find?
Yeah, like mining your own visual language, I think is like a really important thing for artists to do when they get to a certain point, like in their, you know, in their career. And
now with the tapestries, what's really interesting is that I'm working a lot in Photoshop, coming up with different colorways. Like, okay, what if this is light yellow and what if this is peach? And, oh, what if I do a version that's all dark and black and brown and gray? What if I do a, you know, so now it's really become, because I have the drawing set for what's going to, the design, the tapestry design, it's so much now about color, which has been really challenging and also really fun. So that's, yeah, that's really always front and center.
Well, let's chat a little bit about your curatorial practice, because I also know that that's a huge part of your artist identity, but also your job, right?
Yeah,
like you do that as part of like the way that you have a career. So do you want to just maybe not, like, I don't want to go back to the beginning necessarily. Instead, actually, why don't we talk about some recent curatorial projects that you've had? Like what, where are you now in terms of like what you're curating? Are you curating as just like a guest curator? What does it mean for an artist to be a curator? I don't know if I've had that conversation before on the podcast.
So many questions, so many good questions.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm trying to think, where am I going to start? I'll start with the recent project. I'm very honored that galleries ask me to be guest curators in their space, because there's no financial responsibility on me to sell work, which is such a joy. I can really just reach out to artists whose work I admire and am excited about, and I can say, hey, would you like this opportunity to show in this space? And so I feel like it's the best of all worlds. It's a really beautiful space that I don't have to clean. I don't have to wake up and go sit in it. I don't have to worry about selling the work. I just have to worry about finding great art and great artists to shine a light on. So it's like, I feel like I won the lotto in the fact that I get to do this and get paid for it. It's insane. But yeah, I take on projects with galleries that I feel a kinship with, a like-mindedness with. You know, there's people that ask me and I politely decline just because I don't feel like a resonance with the ethos of their space. But if I'm lucky that I can say no to things and do the things that I feel with my heart really passionate about. So I just curated a show here in Nashville at Tinney Contemporary with four artists. It's probably one of my favorite shows I've ever curated. It just all came together really intuitively and beautifully. And it just feels like, I don't know, to be an artist curator, there's so much work that I wish I made. Like, I wish I could make the work that Tyler Renee Angelo makes, who's in the show. He's this phenomenal sculptor that makes work out of volcanic ash and cement. Like, I wish I could do that. I wish I could make ceramic vessels like Sabra Moon Elliott. You know, I wish I could make these beautiful plaster, like amorphic sculptures like Lindsay Davis, or these like super saturated abstract paintings like Hannah Rose Dumas. Like, I wish I could make these paintings and these sculptures, but I make what I make. So being a curator, it feels like cosplaying different artists. It feels like, oh my gosh, I get to show this work that I love and I'm so passionate about, but I didn't have to make it. So for me, that's what it is. It's kind of like, as an artist, I think we all understand intuitively what it means to curate a show, because we understand materials, we understand form, we understand composition, we understand space. I think it comes really naturally to artists to curate. I'm lucky that it fell into my lap. It's not something I ever thought I could do without an art PhD, but it turns out I can. So I'm very lucky it fell into my lap. But what it is for me is it's about being generous to my artistic community and giving opportunities to artists from a place of, you know, love and admiration. And so it's a celebration of the artwork being made in our wider community. And I'm just, my work, my little own studio practice doesn't feel like enough. Like, I want more than what I can do in my own studio. And so curating is like I talk about it as an extension of my studio practice into the world and into the community.
Absolutely. I really resonate with that, and that the work that I, you know, choose to like have an art gallery, or like the work that we jury and curate, I'm just like, it does for me come from that place of like, oh, I wish I made that. Or like, I'd love that thing.
I love it. And I want to celebrate it. And I want other people to see it.
Yes.
How can I make all this happen?
Yes. Yeah. And I totally agree with you that like, I actually was installing a show this morning and just, you know, just had this moment of like, oh my God. And like, this connects with that. And like, look at that. Yeah. Like, I love that moment of like, you had intuition to like choose work, but then when you see it in person, you're like, dang, like this really connects. Like that feeling that you had, you can like see it manifest and you're like, there's something here. Like, and you're learning to trust your own like intuition. And it's just like a cool moment.
Yes. And that happens every single time I curate a show, but it happened like on steroids with this last show.
Oh, that's so cool.
The gallery director is like, oh my God, did you anticipate this happening? I was like, I wish I could say I did, but no.
Yeah. Well, Kimia, you mentioned that now you're at a point where you're kind of like able to pick and choose and turn down curatorial opportunities. Was there anything you did to like build up your resume as a curator? Did you just kind of, I know that you were asked to curate in a hotel, right? Like that was kind of where you started. Is that right?
Yes. Wythe Hotel. I worked at the front for 2 years and became very good friends with the owner. And after 2 years of working at the front desk, checking people in and checking people out, he basically said, we have the financials now to start buying art. And I think this is a program that should belong to you. Mm. That's how I started. And I still do that loosely. You know, I don't live in New York anymore, but I still have a hand in the work that's being purchased for the hotel and the shows that are happening there. So yeah, it was a non-conventional space, art space.
Yeah. Have there been any other steps along your way that you kind of, I don't know, like put in the work to like make something happen so that you could curate, you know, like I'm just thinking if there's artists out there listening who are like, I want to start a curatorial practice. Like what is like an entry point, if you will?
I think I was always thinking like a curator before I realized I could be one. Like, for example, I had folders upon folders on Pinterest of artists I had been collecting over the years, just for my own reference in my studio. Mm-hmm. When this opportunity came for the hotel, I was like, oh, no big deal. I have all of these artists I've been saving for the past 10 years. Let me email some of them.
Yeah.
I think if you're interested in curating, I would start doing research and having folders. And, you know, on Instagram, you can save folders. I have one for sculpture, installation, painting. I have tons of folders. I'm always researching and categorizing and collecting. So I think that's something you can do. And then also, I think outside of the box. So everyone's like, oh, it has to be a show in a gallery. No, it can be a show at your hair salon. It can be a show at a great cafe or restaurant. It can be a show in your front yard. Mm-hmm. It can be a show in a park. When we lived in Brooklyn, we lived next door to Fort Greene Park. And I remember there was this beautiful exhibition of children's artwork that they did around a tree. They turned the tree into a space. So I just think you have to make your own magic and you have to apply the creativity that you use in your studio to your practical life, in terms of like how to string together an art career. Mm-hmm. And that's going to look differently for everyone. There was one artist who started in New York, an art gallery out of their closet, you know, a bedroom. So the sky is the limit. It's just about thinking creatively and running with what you have. Mm. And I think that's what I did at the hotel. And it really turned into a collection that people wanted to be a part of. It's not traditional hotel art that you buy at Target. It's like original paintings and prints by Kathy Bradford and Chris Martin and Marina Adams and Steve DiBenedetto and Yevgenia Baras, EJ Hauser. Like the collection's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it started small and organically. That's the other thing. I think people get grandiose too quickly. Mm-hmm. And great things always take time, and you have to reevaluate and shift and, you know, until you find the right sort of approach. Mm-hmm. That's what the owners of The Wythe allowed me to do. They allowed me to go slow at my own pace and make mistakes and reorient. And so I think that's really what happened. And I learned by doing. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I want to ask a couple more questions about kind of artist mother identity as we move towards wrapping up. I didn't realize that your youngest was not even 3 yet. So, yeah. You know, I'm just curious, like, you've got your first museum show solo coming up, and you've still got a kid mostly at home. Is that right?
Totally at home. Yeah.
So, you know, you first talked initially about this like fluidity and like, you know, I appreciate that, but also it's got to be kind of hard to balance, all of those things. Like, it's not always beautiful when your kids overtake your studio practice, no, right?
Definitely not. I think, my youngest she turned 2 in November, so she's not even 2.5 yet. We have a nanny, so okay. I have someone who helps me during the day, but I also work from home, so okay. I can be in, when she's napping, I'm in the studio for 2 hours, and I'm in and out. So I share, childcare and house duties. I have mm-hmm. an amazing nanny. Her name is Patricia. I couldn't do it without her. And then I also have an amazing husband mm-hmm. who steps in anytime he needs to. And he is an entrepreneur and makes his own hours. So I'm very lucky. Okay. And he has a flexible work schedule and is a very hands-on father. And then on top of that, I have my parents, and they live in Nashville. And that's the reason that we chose to move back to Nashville. So I could never do what I do without the help that I have. Mm-hmm. I also have a lady who, I have a housekeeper. Her name is Gabby. She's amazing. Mm-hmm. And she helps me, get the Cheerios off of the floor and scrape up the sweet potatoes. So I'm not doing this alone. I'm doing this with a team of people, and I'm very fortunate, but I've also assembled that team. And yeah. I'm also, lucky that I can afford childcare. My husband also has a career, and we have a 2-income family, and that's not always the case for everybody. So there's a lot of privilege that comes with that. But
I also know that kind of lifestyle is, I'm pretty sure you've shared that before, that is part of why you left New York, right?
Yes,
to,
it is. Yeah.
To be able to exist as an artist parent and...
It's true.
Have that support structure because
my parents are here. Yeah. In New York, there's no one that I could just send my 4-year-old. Like, when my second daughter was born, I had a C-section and had to be in the hospital. So where is my 4-year-old going to stay? She mm-hmm. stayed with my parents, and I had no hesitation and no worries. Mm-hmm. I was totally focused on the baby, the new baby, and I didn't have to worry about her. So leaving New York was really a really hard decision. It's still a hard decision. I always think about going back, but the reason I have a museum show is because I moved to Nashville. Mm-hmm. I think if we were still in Brooklyn, I would be one of 20,000 artists, mm-hmm. scrambling for the same shows and opportunities. And in Nashville, I'm one of just a handful of mm-hmm. Professional visual artists that live here. So, there are opportunities that come my way that wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah.
So it's a trade-off, but mm-hmm. it truly takes a village. I've had to let go of some control, because I'm also like a control freak with my kids. I want to do everything myself, but mm-hmm. I also want time in my studio. So it's a constant give and take. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that I struggle with that as well. Like the realization that if I want to pursue my career, that means I'm giving up parts of my motherhood experience, in the process. And, I think that's okay. Like you can make that choice and that is okay. Like you, like we don't have to be this like over the top, like I need every moment with my child ever. Like, but also if that's what you want and you're able to do that, great, you know?
I think too, like now that I have two kids, I see how fast it goes. Mm-hmm. Like now that my oldest is six, I'm just, she's like getting so tall and she's like so like excited about school and she's gone for a lot of the day at mm-hmm. school. And so I just realize now how fast it also goes. So I also try not to stress about it. And I try to really savor the time that I have with my little one at home, because I know that in a blink of an eye, she's going to be in preschool and you don't get these years back. That's the other thing that I've learned as a mother is just like, there's so much pressure on us to work and make our own way and be independent and all these things that I think the beauty and the sweetness of motherhood gets lost in it. Mm-hmm. So I really tried to reject that narrative and just lean into, yeah, today I'm not going to get to my studio, even though mm-hmm. it's in my front yard. It's 20 feet away from my house and I'm not going to get to it because I'm going to be cooking lunch for my kids and doing school pickup and Cora has to go to the dentist and I'm going to be with her for that. So, and that's fine. It's totally fine. I think in the end, we all get to where we're going, mm-hmm. wherever that is. Mm. The pace does not matter. And if there's nothing worth missing your children's childhood, mm. you know, nothing worth that. And I really lament, I really feel sorry for people who do miss that because they don't have the help or the support, mm-hmm. or they're just so caught up in the narrative that it's not important. Yeah. That their work is more important. Nothing mm-hmm. is more important to me than watching and being there while my kids grow up. Mm-hmm. And that's been a journey because I went to an all-girls high school and middle school where we were just kind of trained to be like these girl bosses mm-hmm. and these CEOs. We were trained to be CEOs and take over the world. No one ever talked to me about what motherhood was going to be like or what that was going to feel like and the importance of it, the importance mm-hmm. of being available to your children. So that's something I had to come to on my own. And I'm just really happy that I have.
Mm. I'm glad that you have too, and that you're able, you know, as you said, like that you have the resources to prioritize what's important to you right now, yeah. I think is really important. And just acknowledging that not everybody has that and everybody's doing their best, you know?
Yeah. No, it's a great gift to have support and it's mm-hmm. a luxury in the society that we live in. I know mm-hmm. that. I know a lot of parents who, like a lot of my friends whose parents have no interest in helping with their kids. Mm-hmm. My parents are the opposite. They wish that we lived in their house. So. There are other challenges that come with that, but
yes, got to have some boundaries.
Yeah. I'm really grateful for the help.
Oh, Kimia, this has been such a joy. I really, really appreciate you taking the time.
Yes, thank you for asking me. It's so fun to get to talk about these things.
It is. Okay, final five. Feel free to answer these as briefly as you want. Who is your biggest art crush?
Oh my gosh. Louise Bourgeois.
Mm. What is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
My favorite place to travel is Paris. Mm. A dream trip I would like to go on. I really want to go to Egypt.
Mm. I want that for you.
Thank you.
Bring all those papers back in your suitcase.
Exactly.
tell me a film or a book or a podcast or some resource that just has been like a big inspiration to you.
Oh, this book on Michelangelo. It's called The Agony and the Ecstasy. It's a narrative biography on his life by Irving Stone. Changed my life. One of the best books I've ever read. Maybe Michelangelo is my art crush. I don't know. I have such a newfound obsession with this man and his tortured soul. Mm. That I highly, highly, highly recommend this book.
Cool.
Yeah.
Favorite meal?
Persian food of any kind.
And who do you want to give a shout out to just as a thank you or a recognition for supporting you and your work?
My husband, Kenny Klein.
Okay. And where can folks find you? What's your Instagram, if you're on Instagram, or website, all that?
You can find me on Instagram at Alkemi, A-L-K-E-E-M-I, or on my website, kimiakline.com. And there's a link to my Instagram on there as well.
Okay. Awesome, Kimia. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
I appreciate you.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.